From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, four more years for President Barack Obama. Mitt Romney bows out, and a second storm throws a chill into the wreckage of Hurricane Sandy. President Obama won re-election, said we're bigger than red and blue, said he's fired up for a second term.
With your stories and your struggles, I return to the White House more determined and more inspired than ever about the work there is to do and the future that lies ahead.
Mitt Romney graciously acknowledged that American voters chose a different path than the one he laid out.
I so wish that I had been able to fulfill your hopes to lead the country in a different direction, but the nation chose another leader, and so Ann and I join with you to earnestly pray for him and for this great nation. Thank you, and God bless America. You guys are the best. Thank you so much.
And a nor'easter slams folks still reeling from Superstorm Sandy. Here's Staten Island resident Dave Weaver.
The second storm has just made life miserable. And now people have to worry about heat and not dying and surviving.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of the National Journal, Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Big week. You can join the conversation. What's the message from this big, big week of news, election results? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington is Major Garrett, White House correspondent for the National Journal. Major, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom.
And from Washington, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, great to have you this week.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Major. Hi, Jack.
Hey, and Jack Beatty with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Karen, Major.
Let's go straight to it. Major, lessons from this week. We've got a lot, but give us your top line.
First of all, the most surprising thing for me in this election was not that President Obama won. If you looked at the polling data, that was always or looked always to be the ultimate outcome. What was surprising is the internal aspect of his victory in that Republicans had assumed, long argued, and fervently believed in the Boston headquarters of Governor Romney that Republicans would show up in greater numbers with more intensity and enthusiasm than they did in 2008, and that there would be a natural deflation of the Obama support, at least in a percentage basis.
Yep.
Now, there were fewer votes for President Obama, about 9 million fewer than in 2008, but the partisan difference was exactly the same as 2008, 38% Democrats, according to the exit polls, 32% Republicans. Republicans did not turn out more enthusiastically. They did not have the intensity, and there was not, at least within the confines of those who voted and those who thought this election was important, any diminishment of support or ardor for President Obama.
What does that mean? That there wasn't the intensity, or that there just aren't enough Republicans to come out and act on it? That it's a small group that's intense?
They're not enough Republicans, and those who are intense are not enough of a fulcrum to win presidential elections anymore. This was, and Republicans acknowledge this, going to be the last great, if you will, white Republican presidential or predominantly white presidential campaign. And it fell well short. And Republicans have got to internalize that message, understand that the demographic destiny of this country is moving rapidly away from them if they continue to project the messages and the set of messages they have for the national party or to the national electorate. And if they want to content themselves with being a congressional party, preserving their majority in the House and possibly winning it back narrowly in the Senate, they could possibly stay where they are. But if they have any ambitions of being a national presidential party, they have to adapt to these demographic realities.
Karen Tumulty, top line, the intensity miracle not there, demographic lessons here. Your big lesson from this outcome, Karen.
Well, I do think demographics were a huge story. But on top of that, the weekend before this, there were, you know, seven or eight swing states, and it looked like almost any of them could have gone either way. Mm-hmm. And the Obama campaign picked up every single one of them,
yeah,
except for North Carolina. In fact, the only two states that he failed to win that he won 4 years ago were North Carolina and Indiana. That speaks to just an extraordinarily skillful political operation. I do not think, you know, we have seen anything like this.
Where's the Florida outcome as we speak right now, Karen? I think Mitt Romney's conceded there, but is the count done? Is it wrapped in Florida yet?
You know, I don't know. And I must say, just the idea of Florida continuing to count after the election gives me such horrific flashbacks that I don't know.
So what's your lesson? It's about operations. It's about the machinery of getting out the vote, not about ideology, not about these great issues of state and the future?
I think that, you know, it's when it comes down to a closely and deeply divided country, which is what this is, you win elections by knowing who your voters are and getting them out.
Jack Beatty, your top line lesson from this outcome to a long, long campaign.
Class tells. Yes, ethnic groups were important. The changing demography was important. But in the end, it was class that told for the president. He got 63% of the vote of those with incomes beneath $30,000. In the state of Iowa, 68% of the vote of those with incomes under $30,000. Not a lot of minorities in Iowa. And that, you know, those people stood to lose the most because they would have lost by the repeal of Obamacare. They would have lost by the passage of the Ryan budget, which would have, you know, severely cut back on Medicaid. And they got the message of this election. And they also were, of course, the people that for whom Governor Romney seemed to show contempt in that 47% comment that he made not realizing the world was watching. So I think it really, and it puts the president under an obligation as he goes to these negotiations on the debt ceiling and on the fiscal cliff and the rest. He can't betray these people. They have a stake in Medicare. They have a stake in Social Security, in the basic props of a decent life in America.
So class, you say. I don't know, Iowa, you know, it's much more diverse than the old Grant Wood painting there. A lot of Latinos. Here's just a little Republican feedback on this week. Speaking to CNN yesterday, Representative Steve LaTourette, moderate Republican from Ohio, who's retiring, said the election results demonstrated his party needed to change.
My wife's a Democrat, and she was so close to voting for Mitt Romney. But then, you know, Murdoch and Aiken opened their mouth, and we send them running back to the Democratic Party because they think we're nutty. We have the right message on the finances. We have to get out of people's lives, get out of people's bedrooms, and we have to be a national party, or else we're going to lose.
And here's Fox News Bill O'Reilly. Election results coming in Tuesday night saying that the Romney loss points to a demographic shift in the country.
The demographics are changing. It's not a traditional America anymore. And whereby 20 years ago, President Obama would have been roundly defeated by an establishment candidate like Mitt Romney. The white establishment is now the minority.
Through all that, here's what the winner had to say. The victory speech Tuesday night in Chicago, President Obama talking about the value of American democracy.
When we make big decisions as a country, it necessarily stirs passions, stirs up controversy. That won't change after tonight, and it shouldn't. These arguments we have are a mark of our liberty. And we can never forget that as we speak, people in distant nations are risking their lives right now just for a chance to argue about the issues that matter, the chance to cast their ballots like we did today.
Of course, said the president, in victory there will be controversy in a democracy. We're lucky to have it. Even so, can he cut through that controversy, Major? The scale of the issues in front of us now, can the president, can this Congress cut through? It's divided again.
Well, I have a cover story, National Journal, today, and I want to say just a brief commercial. For the first time ever in our history, all of our election content, analysis, data, demographics are free on our website, nationaljournal.com. We've never done that before. And in my cover story, I talk about the hinge of history and that in this campaign there was a spirited advertisement to the country that this was a big choice election, and whatever the outcome, big choices would have to be made. And I point out in my piece, that's not just rhetoric. That's actually true. Now, whether the choices will be made and whether consensus can be found is now the burden of this reelected president. Republicans now know, particularly Mitch McConnell, who told me at National Journal in October of 2010, his number one priority was to make Barack Obama one-term president. He now knows, and every Republican knows, 2008 wasn't a fluke. This president was reelected in his own right in an economic environment that should have and historically had rendered him defeatable. What the president also knows is the 2010 bounce back of Republicans, particularly in the House, isn't a fluke either. They have to deal with each other as executive power and legislative power and find a way to bridge the immediate difficulties of the fiscal cliff. The Congressional Budget Office said yesterday, on the downside, if you don't do it, it takes 3 percentage points out of the U.S. economy. But if you do deal with it, you can kick the economy into a higher gear. Washington is about to ask itself a question it's never asked before. Is it going to, in a political way, through inaction, in a premeditated fashion, impose a recession on this country? And if the answer is yes, we will have reached a new low in American legislative chaos. I don't think it's going to happen. I think the president and the Republicans and the Democrats are going to pull themselves together, internalize the verdict of this election, and get some things done in the lame duck and build a framework or something approximating a framework for 2013.
Karen, what do you say? Your headline in the Washington Post, more gridlock sure to come. Your headline.
Well, that's just it. I mean, the Congress was also reelected almost exactly the way it is. And, you know, the Democrats were very disappointed in the House that they did not pick up more seats. They fell way short. So I don't know where the political pressure really is at this point to actually do things.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. It's Obama. The GOP takes a hit. Still digging out from Sandy this week. Major Garrett is with us from the National Journal. Karen Tumulty from the Washington Post. And Jack Beatty, you can join us. Speaking on Capitol Hill yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid promised an ambitious agenda, the Democrat leader, of course, including filibuster and immigration reform. He said that voters had given the president a mandate, especially on the Democrats' economic argument.
The mandate was, look at all the exit polls, look at all the polling. The vast majority of the American people, rich, poor, everybody agrees that the richest of the rich have to help a little bit.
We'll look at that, how that might turn out. Karen, here's a question online from listener Manga. Says, why is it easier for Republicans to garner enough public support to maintain control of the House than to win the White House? What's the answer to that, Karen?
The answer is redistricting, which has created a lot of districts across the country that are very Democratic or very Republican, but very few that are truly swing districts, which and certainly that was one of the main reasons the Republicans did so well in this election, because it came right after one of these once-a-decade exercises. And so, you know, the congressional districts in America are surprisingly homogeneous, even as the country is becoming less so.
So, Major, here's another comment online. This is a little op-ed from Gustavo. Says, Democratic candidates for the House of Representatives received 54 million votes. Republican candidates, 53.5 million votes. He says, the 233-seat GOP majority in the House can best be called a gerrymandate, to Karen's point. What about it, Major?
Oh, that's that's true. And you can often run statistics on House votes versus, meaning the popular vote as spread across these districts versus the relationship in Congress, and you can often find those distortions. But it is what it is, and the House Republicans have a smaller majority. Actually, the House Democrats did better than many analysts thought they would. They may gain as many as 15 to 16 seats when all the final votes are counted. They have at least 7 now, I think maybe even 8 if one of the races was called overnight. And so House Democrats did encroach on that House Republican majority. It is a smaller majority, but it is still a majority, which means if you're going to get something done legislatively, you have to create some room to bargain with House Republicans. And I think the most important thing to watch after the president gives his remarks on Friday about what he wants to do with the tax rates is how the market responds and how the market internalizes what it hears from Washington over the next 3 or 4 and 5 days. We had a 300-point-plus sell-off the day after the election that was selling on the perception that gridlock would continue. And another down day in the market on Thursday that's still selling off on the idea that Washington can't get its act together. That is real capital as opposed to political capital. Mm. And that is a market sending a signal to Washington that its days of perpetual gridlock are not just about political sandbox games any longer. They're having a material effect on markets, and that will have a material effect on incomes and prosperity in this country. And it seems to me, at some point, that message has to get across to people who function in the public square.
Karen, is that a big enough poker in the back for Congress to make it move?
Well, actually, could I just go back a minute before we leave the House of Representatives? Because we also passed a new watermark there, too, that I think needs to be noted, which is that if you look at the House Democratic Caucus, the Democrats that will be coming into the House in January, for the first time ever, a majority will not be white males. There will be a lot more women and a lot more people of color. And again, they are no longer, and this is a historic first, a majority of the House Democratic
Caucus. Does
that make
a policy difference, Karen?
You know, I think that the situation in the House is that if you're in the majority in the House, you run things, basically. You can do pretty much anything you want to. So the question, it will continue to be, you know, John Boehner's call. But the president has said that what he intends to do in his second term is get out of Washington more, that he was struck by the contrast between the debt ceiling negotiations where, you know, the country basically was on the brink of default. He failed to get the grand bargain he was looking for. And then that December, he went to the country and made the case for extending the tax holiday on payroll taxes. And he won because he was able to get the pressure from the country to come to Washington. And I think that is going to be much more the way you see him operate in a second term.
Well, I don't know, Jack, is it get out and campaign on the issues, maybe even against the House of Representatives, or is it sit down and really dig into negotiations here to try and work something out, or is it both?
I think probably both, an inside and an outside strategy, because the wholly inside game won't work, because it doesn't change the pressures on Republicans. One key pressure, I think, comes from donors and the business community. And from what I've been reading, there's just tremendous concern, and Major just outlined it, about what can happen. And these people are going to make the Republican caucus aware of their feelings. Now, will that mean that John Boehner would be able to bring a bill to, say, raise taxes, taxes on the top 2%? Would he dare to bring such a bill and have it pass largely with Democratic votes, with some Republican? We don't know. Now, some people say he doesn't have the courage to do that. I don't know if it's a matter of courage, just simply a matter of, you know, whether he, well, I suppose, does he want to hold on to his job or not? What about that? What about the tension between Mr. Boehner and Eric Cantor, the majority leader? Is there a kind of how is that going to work out? So all of these things are in play, but I do think that unless you have the outside game, both from the business community and from the president, it isn't going to move for the GOP.
Major, where does the big money lean now? I mean, after all, $6 billion spent on this and people questioning how much the big money players, the deep pockets, got for that. Sheldon Adelson with how many tens of millions in there, and he did not get what he was looking for. Karl Rove still saying on the other side of that money, not buying the White House, certainly not getting it, that he's going to be still on the air campaigning against tax increases in the fiscal cliff debate. On the other hand, there's the argument out there, and you kind of make it, Major, that we could be headed for another hard recession if there's not an agreement here. Does that turn industry, commerce toward consensus here and away from more confrontation?
Well, look, Speaker Boehner said earlier this week that rates increasing is off the table. But he said Republicans in the House are open to new revenue in the context of tax reform. I write this week that many in the Republican conference that I've talked to and many K Street lobbyists who are very tapped into the thinking of the House Republican leadership is that the definition of both revenues and tax reform may take on a very flexible, taffy-like quality in the coming months, and that you can have a broad discussion about increased revenue in a lot of different ways in the context or under the umbrella of tax reform.
Even Grover Norquist making noises in that direction more than
usual.
Yes.
So it's going to be one of these things where you have an evolving semantic universe where what comes under the umbrella of tax reform may be different in the eyes of the beholder, but it creates space at least to have a conversation. And I think the space that this election creates is the first Democratic president since before Harry Truman to campaign and win re-election on a platform in part devoted to raising tax rates. I mean, we have not seen this in modern American history. And the president did that, and he won the argument. And the exit polling data, as Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid suggested, is, if not emphatic, it's certainly heavily on the ledger of higher taxes on the wealthy, and then we can talk about some other structural things, maybe with entitlements. And the president now is the leader of that discussion. But he has to give some ground or at least accommodate Republicans to put the pieces of a deal together. And it just seems to me that, and oftentimes this occurs in American history, it is outside forces and elections that change political attitudes and demeanor. And we have real outside pressures now. They're not theoretical. And we've had an election and a pretty sizable verdict on one side of the tax question, as defined by the president. I just think that has to matter.
Here's Boehner on Wednesday, House Speaker John Boehner. And listen here for maybe a loophole opening here in the middle of this where he talks about closing special interest loopholes.
There's an alternative to going over the fiscal cliff, in whole or in part. It involves making real changes to the financial structure of entitlement programs and reforming our tax code to curb special interest loopholes and deductions. By working together and creating a fairer, simpler, cleaner tax code, we can give our country a stronger, healthier economy. A stronger economy means more revenue, which is what the president seeks.
Maybe an opening right in there from House Speaker John Boehner. Lots of callers here. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I think Major Garrett makes some excellent points. Bill Parcells likes to say, you are what your record says you are. And that's a fact that Republicans and many in the chattering class need to accept. For years, both have repeated the idea that this is still a fundamentally conservative center-right country. And they've been ignoring the demographic and also attitudinal changes that have been happening right before their eyes on a whole range of issues, from abortion politics to immigration to taxation to gay rights. This country has moved. The conservatives for the last 4 years have made it clear that Barack Obama is the opposite of everything they stand for, and Americans reelected him just the same. They need to listen to conservatives like Michael Gerson, who said this was a substantial victory not only for President Obama but also for liberalism.
Ears open, maybe right now. Certainly, you know, you take a hit like that, you'd be wise to listen. But there's all kinds of music. Mark, let me take one more here. Wilbert in Allendale, South Carolina. Wilbert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Those Republicans are loyal to individuals. Global Norfolk is no tax pledge. The group that was pushing the ID voting throughout the South, Southern states, and Pennsylvania. Claiming there's massive voter fraud at the polls. And the longer that party is loyal to those individuals instead of to the American people, they would never win an election. Down in Florida last Saturday, they had bomb threats at the polls at Miami-Dade County that drove people away from the polls for a little while.
Yep.
But after that, people was not going to go back. They were going to vote regardless of what happened. And they were trying to use Florida as a tripwire.
And they stood in line for hours and hours and hours, Wilbert. You're quite right to do that. Still, there are issues about voting. The president mentioned it. We're going to look at it first thing next week. Thanks for your call, Wilbert. If I may get one more, Amy in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Amy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and guest. And I'm a huge fan of the show, and especially Jack Beatty, one of the reasons I listen. I had some thoughts about Obama having been constrained so badly and trying to make progress in his first term, and that was one of the reasons why some people that we know did not vote for him this time. You know, they just didn't see what he had accomplished. And I think that one way he might be able to do better this time is to be very open and transparent on a regular basis in communicating through media and social media to the electorate and say, this is what we tried to do over this last period, maybe weeks or, you know, short period of time, and this is the obstruction we face. And if these are, if what this progress that we think you want, and it is in the best interest of the country and the world, is something that you want too, then be in touch with the people, these people, that are in your district who are trying to block it.
Amy, we've got it. Jack Beatty, I better give that one to you and think about that series of calls right there. And then Amy and what she wants at this point from the president, Barack Obama. I mean, do you see a man here who can open up in a new way? There were times in his first term when, despite his success at campaigning, he seemed like a closed man in some ways, Jack.
Yes, and thanks to Amy. Well, you know, Nick Kristof, who is certainly an Obama fan, has given him an F for communications. And I think Amy puts her finger on a real problem here, that he for whatever reason, and I can't diagnose it, he has not been as lucid and as convincing about his own record as many people think he should be. For example, it shouldn't have been controversial that, quote, the stimulus was a good thing, that it worked. There was a big book just published called Obama's New Deal, talking about all the things this had done for the economy and infrastructure. That shouldn't have been controversial. The president should have campaigned on it. He didn't. It shouldn't be controversial, I don't think, that we have somehow brought off the miracle of extending health insurance in a way that's not going to deepen the deficit. And millions of people are going to have better lives because of it. The president dropped that argument. He barely mentioned the Affordable Care Act in his reelection. He's got to do better, and for just the reason Amy says. We talk about business putting pressure on Republicans. Well, there's also this larger ambit of people out there, Obama's supporters, who can put pressure on the system as a whole to break log jams. And the president, that's his bully pulpit right there, and communicating with his own supporters and through them to the country at large, I think, is just something he's really got to improve on.
We'll see how that works or doesn't. Let's grab one more huge issue with the huge Latino vote here on Thursday. Again, John Boehner telling Diane Sawyer, ABC, it's time for comprehensive reform to the country's immigration laws. That's new. Here we go.
This issue has been around far too long, and while I believe it's important for us to secure our borders and to enforce our laws, I think a comprehensive approach is long overdue. And I'm confident that the president, myself, others, can find the common ground to take care of this issue once and for all.
Karen Templety, how about it? Republicans looking at those demographic numbers. There's immigration. They had big problems with Latinos, just for one. Do you see comprehensive immigration reform coming here? Is that baked into these election results or still not?
Well, first of all, let's explain what the buzzwords mean here. Mm. Comprehensive immigration reform. There's one gigantic question in there. Are they willing to grant some kind of amnesty and some kind of path to legalization for the people who are already here?
I think I heard Sean Hannity say today or yesterday yes on that. A change for him. He's not an official, but he's a big voice.
And that is going to require this party to stand up to a very strong element of its own base on that subject. I think that, you know, Mitt Romney lost any chance he had with Latino voters. I think they stopped listening when they heard the words self-deportation come out of his mouth, mm-hmm. which was essentially also a buzzword way of saying, we just want to make life so hellish here in the United States that people will just get up and leave.
Mm-hmm. And so what through all that, it still leaves the GOP and Democrats with this question on comprehensive. Is something like an amnesty, do you see the possibility of a GOP turn on that or too much base resistance?
I think there is a possibility of a turn, but it's going to require some of their own leaders to talk very frankly to the base about it rather than sort of what they've been doing thus far.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, demonstrators and police clashed in Athens Wednesday as thousands gathered to protest new austerity measures in front of the Greek parliament. Leftist leader Alexis Tsipras said austerity has failed.
I wouldn't be surprised if you were back again in a few months, asking for more cuts, because these measures are going to bring a deeper recession and will have bigger debts.
Donald Trump reacted with fury on Twitter after the election was called Tuesday night. NBC anchor Brian Williams was withering.
Donald Trump, who has driven well past the last exit to relevance and veered into something closer to irresponsible here is tweeting tonight. Here's a sampling. More votes equals a loss revolution. This election is a total sham and a travesty. We are not a democracy.
Okay, and a crowd in Denver celebrated the passage of Amendment 64 there that legalized recreational marijuana in Colorado. Washington State voted the same. Oregon said no. Here's Denver.
64!
We're looking at a week in the news. It's Obama. The GOP takes a hit. Still digging out from Sandy. You can join us with Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, Major Garrett of the National Journal, Free This Week, and our own Jack Beatty. Lots of women headed to Congress. Lots of women headed to the U.S. Senate. Not enough, Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts was saying just yesterday. But still, here it was Tuesday night. Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill secured that second term, defeating Republican challenger Todd Akin. He sparked controversy when he said that women victims of what he called legitimate rape rarely become pregnant. In her victory speech, McCaskill had a message for her supporters.
I stand in awe of your passion and your commitment and your patriotism and your determination that you were going to have a voice in the United States Senate that made you proud.
Thank you, Todd Akin. Wisconsin Democrat Tammy Baldwin won her race for a U.S. Senate seat on Tuesday. She will be the first openly gay member of the U.S. Senate. When she mentioned this in her acceptance speech, the crowd erupted, drowned her out with loud cheers.
I am well aware that I will be the first openly gay member.
On the other hand, in Texas, conservative Republican Tea Party favorite Ted Cruz won a U.S. Senate seat. In his acceptance speech, he said the country should look back to the principles of the Reagan years.
It was morning in America, and it can be again. We need to get back to common sense conservative principles. My pledge to you is to work every single day in the U.S. Senate to champion small businesses and entrepreneurs and to help them do what they do best, which is create jobs and get America working again.
Republican, U.S. Senator from Texas, newly elected Ted Cruz. Don's calling from South Windsor, Connecticut. Don, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Basically, I've got firsthand experience on this. I think the problem is uneducated American public on economics. I give lectures at the University of Connecticut for retired people. I gave two recent lectures. The first lecture, I told them about the financial condition in the United States. The second lecture, half of them didn't show up. They didn't want to hear about it. The facts
it's
are
painful.
Very simple.
Huh? It's painful.
It's the basic problem is we have a present debt of $16 trillion at 3% interest, which is record low, which is $480 billion. The CBO has said the best we can do over the next 10 years with the present plans is to add $10 trillion to our debt. That brings it up to 26. Interest rates will go back to 5. That means we're going to have $1.3 trillion in interest on our debt.
So we've got more work to do, Don. I take your point, but the president's argument during the campaign was that under President Romney, it would be worse.
Well, that's not true at all. In other words, basically, he can say anything he wants, but basically the problem is spending. We should raise taxes. The issue I had against Romney basically was, and I voted for him, I'll tell you, is that this tax thing on Norquist is crazy. They've got to raise taxes, and I agree with it, but it's a one for three. They're not cutting spending, and they've got to cut spending. First thing you got to understand is where are we going to get this $10 trillion for? The Chinese last year sold $36 billion of our debt.
Donald, we've got it. It can send anybody's eyebrows way up right there. There's a vote for Romney, but one that says to Republicans, come on, raise taxes too. Major, can we get that? And on the other side, what about the cuts? Is there, you know, do you see a Democratic majority here willing to buy the argument Don's making there from Connecticut or not?
I do see Democrats moving on the question of structural and gentle but ever-increasing reforms of Medicare and Medicaid. When I say gentle, I mean they start small and they get bigger over time, because one of the things that's true about entitlement spending is it grows exponentially, but also if you make alterations in either eligibility, premium support, or when you are enter the system, age eligibility, or if you raise the taxes on those who are wealthier to pay into the system, you also get exponential gains over time. I mean, it works in both directions. What you need to do is change the underlying policy. And I think there is a growing, there are a growing number of Democrats and a growing number of Republicans in this newly constituted Senate. I think Harry Reid knows he's going to have between 6 and 12 Republicans who, whether Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, gives them permission or not, are prepared to strike a deal. But the one thing I would say about the earlier topic of the president going outside in the country and stumping and going on the hustings, yes, that can work, but it can only work if you are not appearing from a Republican perspective to badger them or to minimize or take away from them the space they need to move in your direction. One of the things about legislative politics is you have to give people a way to save face, to move in your direction, but also preserve their own ability to articulate and embrace a new policy on their own political terms. And I would say time is of the essence for two reasons. One, for any second-term president, you have about 20 months tops to actually get something that's new and different and big, because entropy sets in and the politicking for the 2016 begins to take over. The other issue is if Republicans are going to make any kind of politically difficult deals now, they need to do it immediately. And I mean in the next 6 months, because if they don't, they're going to start looking over the horizon to their own primary problems in the House and Senate. The quicker you strike, the more you can preserve time to explain it later.
But, Karen, with the Tea Party folks who were returned to the House, do you see, a, you know, 6 months of flexibility among the House GOP here and then, you know, turn back to the midterms or no?
Well, I do think that this is problematic. And I don't know. I wish I knew what the secret sauce is here that's gonna break this dynamic. But, you know, in the House, it is going to be very hard to move.
You know, can I ask, Major, and you, Karen, okay, it was Mitt Romney, and it didn't work. Was there somebody else out there that the Republicans might have put up who you think might have brought this home for the GOP, might have won the White House this time? I mean, maybe it's a pointless question at this point, but looking forward, was there somebody else? Karen?
Major? I don't think so, Tom. Look, the Republican Party had six different front runners for the nomination, the largest number in modern American presidential history, the largest since 1968 when there were four different Republicans who for a time had the Gallup frontrunner status. There were six this time. The party was completely at odds about who to nominate and why. For a long time, it was the anyone but Romney party. Then Romney got the nomination, and there was never really a consolidation around Romney. And I'm not sure anyone different than Mitt Romney, certainly among those who ran, but even if those who didn't, I mean, Chris Christie, I don't think he could have. I don't think Mitch Daniels could have or Bobby Jindal. I just think the structural difficulties within the Republican Party and their own sense of trying one last time to stand athwart the demographic and attitudinal, as the caller pointed out earlier, changes in America were going to persist whoever the nominee was.
Karen?
Yeah, I think they've got a pretty good bench for 2016, though. And, you know, it may in fact be that by 2016, America's ready to hear the name Bush again, because certainly Jeb Bush's supporters are going to be pushing him really hard to run.
Bush v. Clinton again?
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, do you think Hillary will come off of her State Department bench there and get in the fray?
Well, her husband apparently wants her to, but I don't know how she feels about it at this point.
She can't have that. First woman president driven to the office by her husband. I don't
know.
Right. That doesn't sound right. Bill in Shenandoah Valley, Virginia. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I want to say that Washington and the news media need to be honest with the American public and tell them exactly what's going on. Because they haven't been.
About what, Bill?
Well, about the 47% that Romney was talking about. I'm a realtor by trade, and he was talking about the Section 8 complexes where people live in free of charge. And
public housing, you're saying. Mm-hmm.
Right. And instead of where Obama was flashing up the veteran and the disabled on the ads in Virginia, Romney was talking about those people, okay?
Bill, do you think 47% of the population lives in public housing?
Well, in the section of the valley I live in, we've got probably about 10 or 12 Section 8 complexes, and some of them pay anywhere from $0 to $25 a month rent. The American public picks up the rest of the $600 and some dollars.
So you're agreeing with Mitt Romney on the 47% bill? You're agreeing?
Not on the veterans and the disabled.
But the gist of his comment...
The ones that are riding the system free of charge because they don't want to work, okay?
Yeah. Bill, let us pick it up. Jack, what are you thinking as you listen to Realtor Bill's observation in his neck of Shenandoah Valley, the way he sees it?
I wouldn't question his observation, but I don't. That isn't my sense of the word of the world. People want to work. Everybody wants to support their family. I hear it on C-SPAN in the morning. People say, "Oh, I see that woman with the Coach bag, buying food with her food stamps." Well, what is she supposed to do? Starve? And you can buy a Coach bag secondhand for who knows what. I mean, look, it's very tough to be at the bottom of this society, and no one wants to stay there. And the incentives on permanently staying on welfare, all that was changed in the 90s, and the lash of losing benefits is on for people all over the society. It's a mean world for people down there, and I just don't see the world the same way our caller does.
Let's go to Bill. Thanks for your call, though. Joe in Marfa, Texas. Joe, you're on the air.
I think, Tom, this is, again, about the biggest problem America has had since 1492. It's race. Nobody gives up. The white race doesn't want to give up their power. And that's the exploitees, the minorities that white American, white around the world, colonized and took advantage of people. Those people finally figured out that they can now be the exploiters. So the question is, and you hear in everything here, race, as is whether the exploiters are going to be just as bad as the people who exploited him previously.
You mean, do we just flip it around?
White America, right?
Well, I don't know, Major. What are you thinking as you hear that Marfa, Texas observation?
Well, look, our country has a history, a sad history of racial exploitation, segregation, and humiliation. We have overcome that in great measure. We are the most diverse and most rapidly evolving culture on planet Earth. There are things that happen in America in the space of 20 years that wouldn't happen in other societies in the space of 100 years. That's one of the things that is great and strong about this country. I think that process ever continues. And look, take the issue of immigration reform just for a second. Immigration reform, if achieved, and the status of those who live in a limbo state of affairs now is regularized and legalized. They will come with that a couple of things. A calming of commerce and a visibility of commerce that will be beneficial to the U.S. economy. There will be people who will be added to Social Security payroll tax rolls, and that will help Social Security in its solvency in the future. I mean, these things can be reconciled and resolved in ways that do tend to benefit the society at large and not exclusively turn on this question of the exploitees becoming the exploiters.
I mean, there may be a different
pluralism in this country does work.
There may be a different sensibility here, Major. David Brooks, conservative New York Times, writes today, looking at demographic research, Hispanics and Asian Americans, he says, a huge commitment to work, they find, in the Pew Research Center polls. But they say also these groups are not resentful of government because they say, that you don't want a modern economy in which you can work more productively, but your wages still don't rise. Bloated financial sector sending the world into turmoil. University system indispensable but unaffordable. Chaotic neighborhoods that can't be cured by withdrawing government programs. I mean, Jack, there's the David Brooks making the argument that in the demographics, it's not a lack of industriousness, but it's a different sense, maybe, of what we want from government.
Yes, and a recognition of what Lincoln called the fostering hand of government, that it can help. I mean, I look at my parents' lives. Where would they have been without Social Security and Medicare? People who worked hard every day of their lives, and their only fault was they didn't get rich. Well, that's the story in this country. Lots of us aren't entrepreneurs or that roster of successful people we heard about at the Republican convention. That's great in America. But not everybody can do that. And those of us who can't, you know, depend upon collective social provision. What did the president say? We're all in this together. And, you know, our welfare state is not so generous that people, it's going to turn into a hammock for people. It's much more like, what did Paul Ryan say? A trampoline. And I think that's one of the things that was decided in this election. We do need government. We do need that fostering hand, both to help people and to make our economy more productive with research and education.
Karen, can we get back to that balance? The country's had it before: entrepreneurship, innovation, and all in it together. Can we reach that again?
You know, I think so, especially, you know, and it's just, I do think it requires looking at this new class of immigrants the way we look at previous ones. And they come in and they do the work that other people won't take, and they do seasonal work, and they work in places like restaurants that don't pay benefits. So that's why Latinos were big supporters of the president's health care plan.
Because they see something that will support them even as they're doing that work. Major, what do you think? Are we on the way to a new consensus or just another round here? Karl Rove says he's pitching right back in with his millions to say no.
Well, one quick word about millions spent in this election, Jack, that didn't turn the tide. Community-based communication from a political nature, neighbor-to-neighbor, door-to-door, works and beat big money. Beat big money handily this election. I've always said money unhinged from messaging and organization is useless, and I think this election proved it.
Here we are, 2012. The vote is behind us. It will be President Barack Obama, a Republican majority in the House, a new, larger Democratic, I should say, majority in the U.S. Senate. And off we go with urgent issues right in front of us. Major Garrett with National Journal joining us today from Washington. Thank you so much, Major.
Always a pleasure.
Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, Jack. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.